going to repeat what I said. The commission notes there are parties seated before it and would ask that you identify yourselves for the record, beginning with the tenant appellant.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Carol Blumenthal, and I represent Ms. Burkhart.
And for the housing provider.
Good morning, Your Honor. Deborah Leggy on behalf of the respondents.
Thank you, counsel. I would briefly like to explain our procedures. They're largely similar to those of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. Each party will have 20 minutes to present your case, beginning with the tenant appellant. The tenant appellant may reserve up to 5 minutes of your time for rebuttal following the presentation of the case to the housing provider appellee. The housing provider must present all of their arguments within the 20-minute time frame and will have no rebuttal time. In our discretion, we may allow additional time for argument to a party in the event that we engage in questions that occupy a substantial portion of your time. The commission's hearing will be recorded on an audio CD. It will be issued in writing and sent to the parties in the next 30 to 45 days. In this case, it was more likely going to be 45. In this proceeding, the commission does not request nor will it accept post-hearing submissions from either party. Please turn off any cell phones or other electronic equipment. We'd like to ask the parties whether they believe that settlement negotiations are an option at this point.
I do not believe so, Your Honor. I do not believe so, sir, based on communications that I've had with counsel for the housing provider.
Ms. Lee?
That is correct.
The commission is not aware of any preliminary matters in this case. Ms. Blumenthal, would you like to reserve time?
I'll reserve 5 minutes.
Right. Okay. Very good. Well, you can begin, ma'am.
Yeah, no. Okay. Mr. Chairman, this matter is the second time that this particular case has been back before this commission. In its first decision, this commission reversed the administrative law judge's decision below that validated the implementation of a vacancy increase. And the case was remanded for the ALJ to fashion an appropriate remedy. The vacancy increase that was in question was implemented on March 31st, 2006. That was the date that Ms. Burkhart became a tenant at the Kennedy Warren, at this particular unit at the Kennedy Warren. She had actually signed a lease on the 25th of March, moved in on the 31st of March, and began paying rent as of the 31st of March, 2006. Now, this is a period of time prior to an amendment to the Rental Housing Act that took place later in that year, in August of that year, that did away with rent ceilings. So at that time, you had a two-step process as a housing provider, basically, in order to increase a rent. You would have to increase the ceiling, have a vacancy increase ceiling taken and perfected, and then you would have the implementation of that vacancy increase. This commission found that on March 31st, 2006, that date was within 180 days of a prior rent increase, and therefore it was invalid. You can't raise the rent more than once every 180 days during that period of time. Therefore, it was invalid. The case was remanded, as I said, to fashion a proper remedy. What the judge below did then was say, okay, commission, you said that the rent was within 180 days, so okay, it's invalid, but it was implemented in the fifth month out of the six-month period before we could raise it. So I'm going to say we'll give her 1 month's rent, we'll give the tenant 1 month's refund, and the rent increases fine from then on out. And so, and we're talking March 31st, and rents are due on the 1st, so basically she said April's rent has to be rolled back to actually, she says in two different places. In one place, she says to $1,701, in another place to $1,614. But basically, we're going to roll back 1 month's rent, and then everything, the rent increase that increased the rent by 156%. Okay, we're not talking a small increase here, but 156% would kick in the next month, because the next month would be the passage of 180 days. Now, that ruling, without any further notice to the tenant, without any further filings to the Rental Accommodations Division. Now, that ruling of the ALJ below, following remand, in her remand order, is wrong in several significant respects.
Let me ask you this real quick. I think this is going to cut to the chase. Under the decision below, the judge said, the facts in this case are identical to those two cases, Osborne v. Charles Smith and Town Center Management v. Wynn. Both of these cases involved a new tenant signing a lease after a vacancy or CPI adjustment after it had been perfected, but the lease implemented the increase in less than 180 days after a previous rent increase. And then using Wynn and Osborne as precedent, the judge then says, in this case, the tenant signed a lease on March 31st, agreeing to pay a rent of $3,915, which was less than the legal rent ceiling, and was based on a properly perfected vacancy increase. However, the housing provider could not charge the increase until May 1st, 2006, 31 days later. Therefore, tenant is entitled to a refund of $2,254 and for the 1 month, that, just as you said. Can I ask you, how do you distinguish? She's relying on two cases.
I understand, Your Honor.
And I'm just asking, can you?
Well, let me just highlight this to say, although, as we've argued in our brief, there's many reasons why this ruling's invalid, but two key issues that speak directly to these precedents that the judge relied upon are, number one, Ms. Burkhart signed a 12-month lease. The housing provider required a 12-month lease to be signed in March. Okay, so if the legal rent, which the ALJ found and basically the commission found, was either 614 or 1701, because in two different places in the order she finds the rent differently. But if that was the legal rent, then the tenant signed a 12-month lease. The only legal amount for that 12-month lease is, let's say, $1,700. And so nothing then can change within the 12-month period. And that's statutory. I mean, that's basic contract law, that if I sign a contract with you that your rent's going to be this for a year, and the statute and this commission and the ALJ had said that rent is $1,701, then you can't change that within a 12-month period. And number two, what the administrative law judge did below is totally right out of the law the notice requirements that are statutory and regulatory. And these statutory and regulatory provisions, this very commission in their original order underlined on page 48 of your original order is saying you have to comply with these notice requirements of the regulations. Now, Osborne sheds no light on this for two significant reasons. Number one, Osborne was a lease from month to month, not a 12-month term. And so in theory, were the regulations to otherwise allow, we could raise the rent every month. Okay, now we do have restrictions, as we've pointed out already in the regulations. You can't raise it except once every 180 days. But the landlord would have been free to give notice, is his 30 days notice of the rent increase, because we have a new term every month.
Let me ask you this.
That's not true for Ms. Burkhardt.
Let me just ask you, if you don't mind, on Osborne first, okay?
Yes.
Osborne, from the decision, says, if the rent administrator had properly concluded in his decision that the landlord violated two provisions of the 1980 Act with the August 1st rent increase, he might still have reached the same ultimate disposition of the complaint, that no liability for monetary damages should be imposed on the landlord in the circumstances of this case. They went on to say mitigating circumstances might be found where the landlord takes timely action to rescind the demand or otherwise neutralize the effectiveness. And in this, in Osborne, the landlord voluntarily refunded the money.
That's correct.
A couple years after.
Which, of course, that didn't happen in this case. But it was a month-to-month lease, and it also states in Osborne that the landlord had previously given notice, a 30-day notice, but to the tenant, but had implemented at the wrong time and then voluntarily refunded the money that... And the court said, well, you don't have to give a new notice now to the tenant. But in Ms. Burkhardt's case, no notice was given to the tenant at all. Okay, the only mention of rent control items, nothing was filed with the to implement the rent increase. Nothing was filed with the rent administrator, which is violative of the regulations, where you have to implement by filing an amended registration at the time. And no notice under, I believe it's 4204.5, which is a notice that specifically says you have to say what the rent adjustment is, how much the increase it is, what was the date of the authorization for the rent increase. No notice like this was ever given to the tenant. So it's not a question of we don't have to give her new notice. They never gave her any notice at all. In fact, the ALJ says, well, this is a vacancy increase, and so those notice requirements don't apply to a vacant unit. Well, the unit wasn't vacant. Ms. Burkhardt was living there. The ALJ is saying this rent increase cannot go into effect. I mean, if she's not even otherwise wrong, which we believe she is, but this rent increase can't go into effect until May 1st, 2006. Well, Ms. Burkhardt had been living there since March. And so it's not a vacant unit. And the rationale of the ALJ is incorrect, the law is incorrect, and the notice provisions are not there. Now, as to Town Center versus Wynn, in that case, there were two separate leases. Again, we're talking new terms here. And they in fact, entered into two separate leases in order to make their timing correct. The first lease was a lease for 27 days, so that a year's period of time could elapse between the last rent increase, presumably. And the second lease was then a lease for a 12-month period.
Can I again, just in the interest of time, let me just ask you.
Yes.
This is from Wynn. We stress that the landlord had a statutory right to the increase. The notice was otherwise proper, and there was no deliberate attempt to deceive the tenant. We held that the deficiency in the notice was not of sufficient gravity to justify denial to the landlord of the adjustment he tried to implement. This is the key part. We believe that the landlord's course of conduct adequately met the notice requirements, although technically deficient by 2 days. Rent control exists to serve valid public policy objectives. Regulatory requirements such as notices of increases in rents and rent ceilings are meant to further these objectives. They are not meant to be simply roadblocks placed in the paths of landlords and tenants to frustrate their relations. In this case, we conclude that the action of the rent administrator in disallowing the increase had the effect of exalting form over substance and was therefore arbitrary. The practical result of that action was to deny permanently an increase the landlord was otherwise legally entitled to because of a two-day deficiency in the notice period, which had no adverse effect on the tenant. We cannot justify the penalty when it is weighed against the transgression. I'm going to ask you, quite frankly, in this case, were we to find for you, what would be the liability to the landlord? Would it be from the point of the failure of notice, the violation of the 180-day period, to the date of the hearing? Would it be the difference in? Would it be calculated on,
it would.
On that? Okay.
Yes, it would. And let me address this form over substance issue, because I have to stress again, we're not saying here that a notice was technically deficient. We're not saying that a notice was 2 days too late or too early. We're saying that no notice commensurate with the regulations whatsoever, and I named a couple of things that would say what you're implementing, what rent increase you're attempting to, what rent ceiling you're attempting to implement in the rent increase. No notice at all like that was given to the tenant. Maybe even more importantly, though, because what this landlord really did is absolutely undercutting the very rationale behind the Rental Housing Act. The Rental Housing Act sets up a system that you go down to the rent administrator and you file, and you make perfectly transparent what you're doing. You go down and you file what your rent ceilings are. And then when you implement a rent, you go down and you file what it is, so that, in theory, any tenant, any non-tenant, any member of the public can go down to DCRA at any time and say, I want to know what is the legal rent on unit XYZ in this building. In this case, the ALJ is saying that the landlord never has to go to the accommodations division. In fact, in this case, nothing was ever filed with the actual rent that was charged. Nothing is ever filed that would implement the vacancy ceiling. So we're not transparent. And remember that the next year, under the Rental Housing Act, if you want to implement your, we call them the CPI increases, but the increase of general applicability that's based on the Consumer Price Index, the form to do that says, well, what's the current rent, and how much is the CPI, and what's the resulting rent? That's what a notice of rent increase looks like. Well, that first number, what's the rent, is supposed to match up with your last filing that says this was the rent. And so that you can track the history of the controlled rents through time. But here, without any statutory or regulatory basis, the administrative law judge says, well, I'm going to give 1 month, and I'm going to ignore the fact that Ms. Burkhart has a 12-month lease, and I'm going to forgive the landlord from actually complying with the notice provisions. And I'm going to forgive the landlord from filing with the Rental Accommodations Division, and I'm going to say he can charge 156% increase in rent without complying with any of these provisions beginning in May, which, by the way, is beyond the scope of time that we're covering in this hearing.
Would we have to overrule Osborne and Wynn? I mean, the rationale, because those are, if taking what you said, this is a strict liability offense, the 6 month raising of rents within the 6 month period, so that any fault would, there's no forgiveness. And in Wynn and in Osborne, there was forgiveness. There was kind of a weighing of the nature of the offense versus the potential liabilities, and there was a result that did not regard that violation, the technical legal, called the technical legal violation, did not did not invalidate the entire rent increase moving forward. And I was just wondering, how do we address Wynn and Osborne in this case, since she relied on them and said that the facts were practically identical?
But indeed, the facts aren't identical. Okay. And important to that is that there was notice. This whole regime of notice to the tenant and notice of filing was not injured by Osborne. Osborne says that the landlord had already given previous notice to the tenant, and we're not going to make them give it notice again. Well, Ms. Burkhart's not even being afforded the original notice of any legal notice, any regulatory notice. The rent administrator's not afforded any dignity at all. Why bother to go file down there? This wasn't a tough rule to comply with, Your Honor. 180 days is 6 months. I can almost count that on two hands.
You got 2 minutes left.
This is a sophisticated landlord who had engaged we know that rent ceilings were abolished 5 months later. This landlord knew exactly what he was doing, knew that rent ceilings were likely to go away, and was trying to get these units out of rent control before that couldn't happen, because we also limited what you can do with comparable units. And they used a scheme to raise the rent 156%. Okay, from $1,600 or $1,700 to nearly $4,000 a month. That's violative of rent control. And if rent control means anything, if the Rental Housing Act means anything, we cannot just cavalierly say, oh, well, you don't have to comply with any of these things at any time. And the mere fact that it took the administrative system 10 years to say it, who should bear that burden? See, had we had a hearing when we should have had a hearing, then you can correct under Osborne or something. You give them notice now and in 30 days. Go ahead. Now, that didn't happen. But who should bear the burden of what didn't happen properly in this case? And I suggest to you that under the Rental Housing Act, the proper place for that is for the housing provider to bear.
Do you have any questions, Commissioner?
No questions, sir.
Thank you so much. Ms. Blumenthal, you've got 5 minutes after Ms. Luigi's presentation. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to the argument regarding Wynn and Osborne, our position is that for the Commission to reverse the decision of the hearing, or the administrative law judge, as to only, in essence, commencing the vacancy increase as of May 1, the Commission would have to reverse both Wynn and Osborne, because factually and legally, the Commission in both of those cases is saying that the tenant had notice, and specifically, in the wrong spot, in Osborne, the Commission, in fact, said that the tenant had received actual notice of the tenant's intent to change by signing the lease. Ms. Burkhart had notice of what her rent of the $3,915 by signing her lease. The fact that there is this argument about increasing her rent is frankly a red herring. Ms. Burkhart always knew her rent was $3,915. The administrative law judge determined in the hearing on remand that as of March 31st, that the rent ceiling, or March 31st, 2006, since we're a bit further along, that the rent ceiling for the unit was $4,483, but that the rent could only be, as of that date, $1,701. But that later, as of May 1, that rent could be increased to $3,915. And that's also in line with the Commission's decision in Guerra, which the Court of Appeals has also affirmed the reasoning in Guerra, that a rent can be recalculated. You can, the concept that it's form over substance, you don't necessarily, because there's one rent increase that is considered invalid, do you invalidate every subsequent rent increase that occurs, whether it's been 6 months since the filing of that rent increase, or in this case, 10 years. You don't, our GARA would say that you would not invalidate every subsequent increase. And in the same respect, when an Wynn does cite to GARA as part of the reasoning behind the decision to say on equity principles, in essence, that it would be reasonable to make the same argument that you recalculate it for that period until that 180 days elapses. Part of that is because a landlord is absolutely entitled to that vacancy increase. And the arguments that are taken otherwise remove that entitlement. The only way that a landlord can obtain that entitlement would be to...
Let me ask you this. If I read to Council Blumenthal the exact language out of this opinion below, and it says, the facts in this case are identical to Osborne and Town Center. Do you are the facts, in your view, how are the facts identical? Because that's the only way you can reach the conclusions that Wynn and Town Center do on their particular... The word that's used in both of those decisions is circumstances. And under these circumstances. So the facts, are they similar, if not identical? Here they say identical. And secondly, if they're not identical, then do Wynn and Osborne, can Wynn and Osborne be distinguished on their facts and the results, because they are kind of the exception to the rule, not the rule. And you would be under, again, there's an acknowledgement that you did raise the rent within the 6 month period and then admitted the violation of the Rental Housing Act. However, the nature of the violation had to have been based on the circumstances of this case was sufficiently not minor, but somehow did not trigger the ultimate penalty here, which would be, look, there was a mistake made. It was done within 6 months. We take it from the date of the mistake and we say, okay, from now on, from that point forward, every single rent increase is invalid. And the nature of the liability is the difference between what the last legal rent here, and that would have been, I guess, at the beginning of the 6 month period, and the date of the hearing. So I'm just wondering, how do you distinguish your case as being on all fours with Osborne and Wynn, because those are the two critical cases that the judge appears to rely on. If you could help me there, I'd really help. I appreciate it.
Our position is that in both of those cases, the tenant had the same notice as the tenant in this case did, that in all three of these cases, that there was a determination that a vacancy increase was not implemented or was implemented too early. And Osborne, it was a 4 month delay. Here it's 31 days, and when it was 28 days. The exact amount of time, the commission has not said, was in of itself the deciding factor of whether or not the vacancy increase was lost forever. I would also note that the argument that was presented at the end of our argument by opposing counsel, that the housing provider was trying to increase the rent outside of rent or above what rent control would allow has no basis in the record, so I don't think that that should be considered by the commission. But more importantly, the court in, forgive me, and Osborne focuses on this concept that it is, that these filing requirements that are in these deadlines are not simply a roadblock, that in the facts in this particular case, the tenant died, the former tenant of Unit 901 died. A housing provider cannot predict those things. A housing provider could not, or, and it could have been an instance where 2 days after a landlord increased the rent, the housing provider, that could have occurred. That doesn't mean that those are the circumstances of this case. But to now, because the landlord made a mistake, increased the rent 31 days in advance, should not mean that forever that the housing provider also lost that increase, but that the tenant who agreed to a rent of almost $4,000 is now entitled to have her rent reduced to $1,701. The equities would say she agreed to a rent also, and the housing provider was entitled to that vacancy increase because that other tenant was no longer residing there and had vacated. So in that same circumstance, the equities also say the landlord was entitled to that increase, and now the basis, the fact that the tenant was permitted to, made, or the landlord made the mistake of allowing the tenant to move in 31 days in advance, should not mean that forever that they have lost that increase.
Let me ask you this. If what happened here doesn't really fall within the excuses that were provided in Wynn and Osborne with respect to the facts of those cases, there is something in Osborne that says there was an attempt to refund the money. There was an attempt. These are what they called mitigating circumstances with respect to liability. In other words, Osborne said, "Okay, the rent administrator made a mistake. It was an error of law that the rent administrator found." They made an error of law in not finding the violation of the six-month rule. But, nonetheless, this is the critical sentence to me in Osborne. I'm sorry to go through these, but these are the cases that are relied on. If the rent administrator had properly concluded in his decision that the landlord violated two provisions of the 1980 Act with the August 1st rent increase, he might still have reached the same ultimate disposition of the complaint, that no liability for monetary damages should be imposed on the landlord in the circumstances of this case. So, okay, he might still have reached the same ultimate disposition of the complaint. Okay, with respect to liability here, there was an assessment of 1 month's rent, the difference between the charged amount moving forward and the existing amount, and that was awarded for 1 month. How does that cure the fact that the notice was, the fact that two rent increases were taken within a six-month period that is not allowed by the Act? How does that remedy cure the nature of the violation?
The nature of the violation was that the landlord was not entitled to benefit from a rent increase prior to May 1. By the administrative law judge providing the award of approximately $2,600, the administrative law judge was determining that ensured that the landlord no longer benefited from taking that increase early. the administrative law judge determined that the tenant had already obtained notice of that higher rent of $3,915 by signing the lease. There's been no argument by the tenant that they didn't receive notice of a lower rent charge, and their argument that the rent has, that they didn't receive notice of this May 1 increase. And the reason for that is the contract they signed, the lease, says what it says, and they're trying to recharacterize the lease in a way that's frankly not before the commission, because the commission can't, and our position is cannot consider whether the lease says $3,915 or whether by the decision of the commission, whether that ends up canceling that term in the lease, at which point, frankly, it would mean that the term in the lease was canceled as opposed to it having a new term and substituted, according to the petitioner's argument.
Okay, and when, again, I'm asking you because these were, this was the only support provided in the determination below for the decision. When we believe the landlord's course of conduct adequately met the notice requirements, although technically deficient by 2 days, then it says rent control exists to serve valid public policy objectives. Regulatory requirements such as notices of increases are meant to further those objectives, but they are not meant to be roadblocks placed in the paths of landlords and tenants. The practical result of the action here was to deny permanently an increase the landlord was otherwise legally entitled to because of a 2-day deficiency in the notice period, which had no adverse effect on the tenant. We cannot justify the penalty when it is weighed against the transgression. If the penalty here moving forward is over an extended period of time from the date of the alleged transgression, the liability is considerable. And here and when it appears to say we cannot justify the penalty when it is weighed against the transgression, and that, on the one hand, one might say, well, the transgression is a strict liability offense. Once you violate the six-month rule, you violate it, and moving forward, every rent adjustment then is invalid. You roll that back to the last valid one, which would have been at the beginning of the six-month period. And then from the date of the hearing back to that point, that's the nature of liability. This says, look, we can't justify that penalty when weighed against a 31-day or 28-day you're short 28 days from the six-month period. Here it's 2 days, 28 days, using the same rationale. When I weigh these two things, we got to kind of, based on the circumstances of when they made their determination of damages here, we somehow, in order to affirm, we have to find that what the court did below, which is award essentially 1 month's a refund for 1 month between the $3,900 and the maximum amount of the rent of $1,701 in the lease. So I'm just wondering how help me use when, or please frame this in a manner that I can understand how the court reached this result based on when and Town Center. When and Osborne. These are the two cases that were relied on. This was the only support. There was no support from the statute, and there were extensive quotations from each case. I've been asking for that. I need, how does this fit Wynn, and how does this fit Osborne? If you could help me, because that's, and then how, then what is the, is, has the liability been satisfied under both of those cases? Has everything been adjudged correctly? These are the questions that are before us.
I'll start with the liability.
Okay.
Our position is that the administrative law judge's decision that the $2,600-ish dollars was an appropriate determination of liability for the mistake of not waiting until May 1 to implement the vacancy increase. That is why the landlord did not file a notice of appeal in this case.
So the liability then would be, in again, using these terms from Wynn, and would be somehow proportional to the nature of the offense.
Correct.
The offense was innocent? Is that your
That's our position.
Your position? It was, not intentional? It was a mistake, an administrative error?
And frankly, it was a tenant's burden to show that it was not a mistake. It was her burden of proof.
Okay.
And there's no evidence in the record to show that it was anything but a mistake.
So you really rely on Wynn, or the court below, you think, relied on Wynn and Wynn and Osborne as essentially admitting the mistake, admitting the violation under the Act, but mitigating the liability because of, for example, prior notice, there was a correct perfection of the whatever the next elite, you know, whatever the correct perfection of the rent charge, the next rent charge.
I will say I'm not sure when the mistake was determined, because I don't know that answer. I don't know that that answer was determined during the hearing or not. I will say that my reading of the hearing examiner's, or sorry, the administrative law judge's determination was, her position was that the, based on the findings of fact that she made, that there was no evidence that the housing provider had done anything more than made a mistake, and as such, that she could rely upon Osborne, that she could rely upon Wynn. And there's, frankly, as far as I can tell, no, those are still good law before the commission. There's not, or the reason the administrative law judge relied upon those is because those are cases from the 1980s that the commission has not had an occasion to consider again since that time.
Let me ask you this. Are you familiar with the case called Benson Pennick v. D.C. Rental Housing Commission?
I am not. I had tried to, if that's something similar, I tried to do a search and had not been able to find anything that was similar.
Well, Benson Pennick, a 1994 case, tends to run against what you just said. And the determination was pretty quick, as a matter of fact. According to D.C. Code 2518G, no adjustments in rent under this chapter may be implemented until a full 180 days have elapsed since any prior adjustment, citing to Osborne and Borger Management v. Godfrey, which I have here too. The evidence in the record indicated that the housing provider increased the tenant's rent from $700 to $925 within 31 days from April 4th to May 5th, 1985. Therefore, the housing provider increased the tenant's rent before the 180 days had elapsed, which was prohibited under the Act. And this is a case that goes the other way, citing Osborne and this other case as precedent. The other case doesn't really, it's not really helpful. Though it is also suggests a strict construction of the 180-day period as being, again, I call it a strict liability offense, that once you offend, there's no mitigating circumstance off an offense of that nature. And Pennick would seem to stand for that. Now, Osborne and Wynn don't. Osborne and Wynn suggest that there are mitigating factors with respect to, you can still acknowledge the mistake and mitigate the liability. based on the nature of the mistake and the relative harm to the tenant. And I'm just not hearing what I've been asking for. Those are precisely what the judge obviously had to rely on because she cited Osborne and Wynn only. Only those two cases. And I'm just wondering, please help me here again. And you got a few minutes left. I'll give you another, just a few minutes. How do Osborne and Wynn fit your case, and why could we then regard the use of Osborne and Wynn outside of the fact that they haven't been overturned yet? How are they on all fours? Here the judge says, as I said, the facts are identical to two cases. And I would have thought that the one thing I would have wanted to do from the very beginning is fit this case into those cases somehow. And I need a summary statement of how these cases fit.
And our position is that they fit because in the same respect as both of those cases, the tenants were on notice of that higher rent amount.
Okay.
The landlord was not entitled to implement that higher rent amount until a date later than what that rent was originally implemented. And
the nature of the mistake here was similar to the mistakes made.
As I understand both Osborne and Wynn, yes. I mean, here it's as best as I can tell, and as frankly the record is not showing anything from the petitioner's side as to anything other than this, a miscalculation of 31 days is
28 days.
Well, in my case, it's 31 days. Okay. Ms. Burkhardt, the rent increase was implemented on March 31.
Okay.
It could not have been implemented actually until May 1.
Okay.
And so, although that was early and was not when it should have been, in both Osborne and Wynn, the commission decided that although they were not in our, that rent increase should not have been implemented till a later time, that the out of determination that they did not want to focus on just the technicalities of the act, but also the fact of, as I understood both the cases, a bit of overall fairness that the landlords were entitled to those vacancy increases.
So there was, you're absolutely correct. That's how you have to read those two cases. You have to read them almost as kind of a legal error, but an equitable result based on the nature of the error was not. Again, there are mitigating factors, and those are those are terms that are used in those cases. And I'm trying to plumb with you I'm getting a better sense now of where you think these cases fit your case. And why the judge was correct in citing these two as the sole precedent for this decision.
And unfortunately, I just do not know the facts of Penick to know what type of increase was implemented at that moment in time.
And Penick is apparently there's others, but I haven't been able to find them. But all I'm saying is that there seems to be a split of decisions, and Osborne and Wynn do seem to be somewhat consistent. But again, I think that both of them, there is an acknowledged violation of the act, but the nature of the remedy is kind of is much more of a balancing test where you weigh the harm to the tenant versus the harm, you know, the ultimate harm to the tenant versus whatever the remedy was below. And moving forward, you don't want unrestricted liability on anyone. So I'm just trying to figure how these fit.
And I think it's also important to note in all three of these cases that we're talking about leases. These are cases where, as opposed to a rent increase, where a tenant is frankly given an option of taking a rent increase or leaving, or attempting to negotiate with a landlord, the tenant has already agreed to a rent. There may have been prior negotiations. We don't have facts in this case regarding whether there were negotiations or not. We don't have any facts regarding that in Wynn or Osborne. But it is also, in all three of those cases, a situation where there has already been an agreement between the parties on what the rent was to be. So I think that was, at least as I understood it, an underlying thought. I don't know that that was articulated as well in either of those cases, but to me that's always an important consideration as opposed to rent or just general rent increases that occur.
I understand what you're saying. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want to say, do you have anything else, or is that, you answered what I needed to know? Ms. Blumenthal, sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, in this case, the finding was Ms. Burkhart signed a lease on March 25. The landlord didn't even file the vacancy increase until March 29, 4 days after Ms. Burkhart signed the lease. Now, the landlord didn't sign the lease until sometime later. But they already knew who their tenant was. They had already signed up with Ms. Burkhart, had her sign the lease on March 25. They had her deposit. They had her first month's rent. And then they went and filed a vacancy increase and did not bother with the implementation regulations. The second thing I urge you, Your Honor, since the focus here has been on Wynn and Osborne, I would urge you to focus on a really critical difference in Wynn, and I'd ask you to focus on footnote 8 in the Wynn decision. The hearing examiner, and I have cited this in page 7 of our brief, the hearing examiner in Wynn noted that the housing provider could have just waited 180 days from implementing the vacancy to implement the vacancy increase and then taken, it was, in Wynn the problem mm-hmm. was a vacancy and a CPI increase coupled mm-hmm. together. Mm-hmm. So he said it could have just waited 180 days from implementing the vacancy increase and then taken the CPI. The commission in footnote 8, this commission in footnote 8, responded, quote, it is doubtful that this was correct. Section 209E of the 1980 Act, D.C. Code 1981 edition 4515-19E, provides, quote, no rent shall be adjusted for any rent unit for which there is a valid lease agreement or rental agreement establishing the rent for such rental unit for the term of such written lease or rental agreement. They couldn't have just waited 180 days and then filed the rent increase because there was a 12-month lease in place. Ms. Burkhart had a 12-month lease in place. Therefore, whatever the legal rent was on day one of that lease would remain the legal rent for at least 12 months. And this she had notice by the lease. Not only does that not meet the regulations, I suggest to you that that is not, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I suggest to you that that is not simply in this context, in this circumstance. And as the chairman's pointing out, that Osborne and Wynn are both very circumstantial cases, that in the circumstance of this case before you now, this is not merely a technical violation since they didn't even file the vacancy increase for the ceiling until 4 days after they had Ms. Burkhart on lease. I also just would like to just mention very briefly that there was a second issue on the remand from the commission, and that was whether or not, that was to get a ruling on a motion to amend to include a registration issue as part of the proceeding. I would submit to you our brief on that subject, but also say, the case obviously has a complicated and tortured history and a change of judges and lost documents, etc. But the bottom line is that Judge Pearson, the administrative judge below, ended up denying this motion to amend based on a prior judge's ruling in a summary judgment motion, in effect. And while the issue was raised in the motion for summary judgment, a denial of a motion for summary judgment merely means that the issue goes on to trial. It is not dispositive that the issue is forever decided, and therefore we're not going to look at it again, which I think is what Judge Pearson was really doing.
Okay.
And so that issue of whether there was a proper registration should have been allowed. The motion, we would submit that the motion to amend should have been granted to allow the registration issue. Indeed, the prior judge had actually entertained it was no surprise to the landlord. It was entertained as part of the summary judgment motion. The tenant did not prevail on summary judgment on that motion, but should not have been precluded the opportunity from raising that.
Okay.
And with that, unless there's further questions, I would submit here.
Do you have any questions, Commissioner?
I do. Leggy. My question is that what would be the problem in 2016 that this commission today, in its interpretation of the act, determined that the 180 days is in fact strict? What would be the problem with that? And if there were a problem, what number of days would you count it back to? Is 75 days? Would it have been 33 days? I mean, we're getting into the number of days that they initiated the increase. So 31 days was okay. It's just a pimple. When does it get to a mountain? Is it 50 days? Is it 75 days? How many days would you concede that it actually would have been a problem that could not then have been mitigated, which would then have required the strict application of the 180-day rule?
Well, I think that the decisions in Wynn and Osborne say that it depends on the circumstances of each case. And forgive me, I confused the two. One of the cases was 28 days, and the other one was 4 months. And so I don't think that you can say specifically that 28 days are in one situation may not be acceptable, and in another situation, 5 months may be acceptable. I think it depends on each, or based on those cases, it depends on the circumstances of each case.
So it'd be fair to say that the 180 days is just kind of willy-nilly because based on the circumstances that each in the commission in the past has viewed the 180 days not to be strictly applied, unlike the case in the 1990s, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
In the 1990s, they don't seem to, that commission seems to pay much attention to the amount of time when the rent increase was taking place. So again, why would it be necessarily inappropriate with a new commission some many years later to say, you know what, we view this to be something that's strictly applied and that there's no possible way to mitigate it based on the day. So in essence, what I'm asking is, in your same conversation with the chairman, would your argument be the same if we eliminated the issue about the number of days? Just admit that. What are the other independent mitigating factors that you would then rely on if you were not going to say it was such a short period of time?
I apologize. I'm not sure I understand your question.
So
are you saying that the other factor, or would we only be able to look at the other factors?
Yes. What would the other factors be in your case that would be similar to the factors if you discount the timing of the application of the rent increase? How are your circumstances now similar?
I think that the answer to the commissioner, to the chairman, is identical. Our focus was not on the time frame because the time frame has, based on those two cases, it seemed to not be outcome determinative, but instead it was a factor that was considered, but is not the only factor that was considered. And so, so in this case, yes, there was a increase that was taken earlier, but there's also the factors that the case has been pending for 10 years, and to now are, it's very difficult to say that after 10 years that you are now asking that the rent be rolled back to that point. It's
So if the case had happened quicker, if it was in 6 months, your position would then change, correct?
No.
Okay.
But you also look at the fact that the landlord there's a difference between as I said before, there's a difference between a vacancy increase, which is a much higher increase than CPI, which some years is 1%, some years is 3%. Just depends on the circumstances. There's just so many different circumstances for each particular case. This was a much higher increase than normally would be permitted because it was a new tenant, because they were taking a vacancy increase.
So let me ask you, and I apologize for interrupting, just going again back to the statute, which indicates that you cannot take an increase within the specific period of time of 180 days. You would agree that reading that statutory provision by itself, it doesn't lend itself to allow for anyone to mitigate or provide any provisions that would lead the commission to then determine what mitigating factors, or if there are any mitigating factors, when determining any potential damages or otherwise. Well, it doesn't read that way. So when the commission applied it in the 80s, they essentially added that or applied it in such a way, but the statute doesn't provide for that. Isn't that fair?
I think that there are multiple interpretations of every statute, and in this case, in both Osborne and Wynn, the commission decided that there also has to be an equitable consideration, and that is why they made that determination.
So, Ms. Blumenthal, why would you say in this instance that it would be inappropriate if the commission were to go ahead and weigh the equities and then find some types of mitigation based on the time that it's taken this case to get here, based on the fact that we're talking about a vacancy increase as opposed to some other types of rent, annual rental increases? Why would it be inappropriate for the commission now in 2016 to continue to view the statute and interpret it that allows us to then add these added steps to this process?
Because, Commissioner, the language of the 180 days in the statute and the regulations doesn't allow for mitigation. The language of notification to the tenant is mandatory. They shall have this notice. And the facts of Osborne and Wynn do not support that in my view, that if equitable considerations are to come into play here, that they should be, that they would weigh on the side of, we dispute that they would weigh on the side of the housing provider. And I pointed out, number one, the lease is signed on the 25th. They don't even try to take the vacancy increase. They don't even file it. The ceiling increase, the actual authorization to take an implementation, they don't file until 4 days later. So how could they possibly have figured that? That certainly doesn't cut equity in front of for the housing provider not to give the appropriate regulatory notices. Number two, the circumstances of Osborne and Wynn in significant respects are distinguishable.
If I were to ask you to specifically outline in this case the, as we would call, technical filing errors that the landlord committed
Yes.
Would you be able to kind of, were there two of them? Were there three of them? So if you're going to do this weighing of...
There's at least three that come immediately to mind, and I could check my brief for more.
So if you weigh those three, it'd be fair to say that those three filing errors, technical filing errors, would kind of weigh against this whole idea of the... mitigating damages, because it's not like one thing, it's just several, three things that might change the scale.
Well, that's correct, although I would take exception, if I may, to calling them technical errors, because these are errors that of the filing with the rental accommodations office. And, I mean, you may say, as I think the housing provider is arguing, the notice provision, while I'm saying that there's much more that has to be in the notice, according to the statutes and the regulation, than a line in a lease that cites the wrong rent, but if we call that a technical violation, because the housing provider argues, well, she signed the lease, so she knew there was the rent was a certain thing. I do not agree that the lack of a filing of the rent with the rent administrator, which is the very basis of the remedial provisions of the Act, that you file with the rent administrator so that the rent administrator, at least in theory, can look over your filing and see if it looks correct, if it looks timely. They don't do that. They don't honor the 180-day provision. So, yeah, three violations, but I wouldn't characterize them as technical. I think they're three substantive violations. And substantively, these two cases, Osborne and Wynn, are not our case. We do not have, as in Osborne, a landlord voluntarily repaying overcharges to the tenant. We do not have a month-to-month lease, and I do think that that is key, and that's why we should draw the Commission's attention to footnote number 8 in Wynn. It very much addresses, it's not just a question of waiting the 180 days. Once you have... It's the landlord who provides the tenant a lease. It is the landlord who says, well, you sign up for a year here. That's what you do.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
What's your name again? I'm sorry. What's your name again?
Ms. Leggy.
Ms. Leggy.
Ms. Leggy, okay. All right. I want to hit on Ms. Blumenthal's point as far as the month-to-month lease. Can you discuss your views on that part?
I don't think that our position is the fact that it's a month-to-month lease has no bearing on this, because whether or not the tenant and the landlord are obligated to a one-year term or simply a month that the occupancy remains does not obviate the requirements of rent control. The requirements of rent control are specifically, as has been discussed today, regarding the 180 days that you cannot increase the rent from one time to the next, or from one rent increase to the next. The requirements of rent control are that you specifically can only increase it a certain percentage based on which provision under the Act that the rent increase is implemented, and then previously the issues under rent ceilings that are no longer an issue. But whether a tenant is a...
I'm sorry to interrupt. In relation to footnote 8 that she keeps mentioning as well.
Well, as to footnote 8, yes, in this case, and in when there could not be a situation where a landlord could, a month, 2 months after an... regardless of whether there was an issue of a improper filing or we are dealing with a tenant that is not in a rent-controlled building. Upon signing a one-year lease, the landlord's obligated to pay that rent for the following, or to accept that particular rent for that following year. The fact that that fact has nothing to do with whether or not the rent control filings are appropriate. They're separate and apart. In the same way, if a tenant continues to reside in the unit after that one-year term expires, they can, upon 30 days notice or less, if they so are, depending on the terms of their lease, leave. But either way, the landlord, after the expiration of the one-year lease, can only increase the rent at certain periods. In this case, what the commission's saying is, in Osborne Wynn and now the decision by the administrative law judge, what they're trying to say is that based on equitable provisions that are, as I understand, the all three of those cases, that these are individuals that agreed to a certain level, but because of rent control principles, they were not allowed to be, the landlord specifically was not allowed to charge that higher amount until a later date. Because of that determination under rent control, under contract principles, that determination still meant that they were later entitled to that higher rent. It just happened that because the document themselves, or that these tenants signed and the landlord signed, provided notice to the tenant of the increase in rent, or of that higher rent, to be specific.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It's obviously a case of, it really does raise a lot of critical issues, but both of you handled it well, and thank you for your patience. It is it's now 12:17, and we adjourn. Thank you very much.
Thank you.